Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
When I was in college, two classmates asked me to leave the Black Student Union. That's because my face doesn't reflect my African American ancestry.
To get to the heart of this country, one must examine its racial soul.
That's Attorney General Eric Holder, a man that might have been called High Yeller in the days of my grandfather. He works for a man whose skin is also light brown instead of black.
Though this nation has proudly thought of itself as an ethnic melting pot, in things racial, we have always been, and we, I believe, continue to be, in too many ways, essentially a nation of cowards.
Am I black? Is Eric Holder? Is Barack Obama? And are we favored because our genes are at the light end of the color spectrum? No ducking the question here on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, January 12th, and the takeaway for me, John, is that if Harry Reid's comments actually spark a real discussion about this issue, then I am glad that he misspoke.
Well, it's clear that this has been an issue throughout most of your life.
Absolutely.
I kind of want to say, take that, Black Student Union. Well, it's a conversation we're going to be having all morning. Let's get right to the top stories we're following, though. A new government report shows veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars are committing suicide at a higher rate. Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki says they can't figure out why the suicide rate of returning soldiers jumped 26% from 2005 to 2007.
Where you can splint and patch physical wounds, as you well know, emotional injuries don't lend themselves to such fixes. But we must continuously develop equivalent accommodations. I don't know what they are.
And if you include all former soldiers,
that means on average 18 veterans commit suicide each day.
Shocking. Of the 30,000 suicides in the U.S. each year, get a load of this, nearly 20% of them are veterans.
Better news from the Fed this morning. The Washington Post is reporting the Federal Reserve made $45 billion last year. That's the highest earnings in the history of the central bank. That money now goes back into the Treasury. But first, Scott Talbot joins us. He's the chief lobbyist for the financial services industry at Financial Services Roundtable. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Celeste.
So we're going to hear about bonuses that are to the tune of hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars. Why can't they just roll that into salaries?
Well, the bonus is designed as an incentive pay. It's designed to encourage employees to work hard. Without them, you simply have the base. And the bonuses can be adjusted up or down, but depending on performance. It's an important part.
But even banks that are losing money are giving very large bonuses.
Yeah, but the bonuses are aimed at the employees, not the overall bank. I mean, part of the component of bonus will become the bank's performance, but the bonuses are really aimed at the individual employee's performance.
All right, Scott Talbot, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Richard Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, says there will be political consequences if a health care reform bill includes a tax on the so-called Cadillac insurance plans.
The Senate bill, from our point of view, is inadequate. It does not deserve the support of working men and women.
The AFL-CIO disagrees with the Obama administration, apparently. The proposed tax on the premium insurance plans would affect 1 in 4 union members.
Heading overseas to Iran, a bomb attached to a motorcycle killed a professor of nuclear physics outside his home in Tehran. It's not clear if he was involved in Iran's contentious nuclear program, but the government there is blaming the U.S. and Israel for the targeted killing. And former baseball star Mark McGwire finally admitted taking steroids on and off for 10 years, including during his record-setting home run season of 1998. There were suspicions about his drug use since he entered the league. They were only heightened when a steroid was found in his locker during the 1998 season. Taking a look at the markets, Asian markets are mixed. European indices down. Futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,663, the S&P at 1,146, and the NASDAQ at 2312.
Coming up on the show, we're still talking with you about Senator Harry Reid and his controversial comment about President Obama's race.
I am not offended.
Reid said nothing but the truth.
It's still racist.
We want to have a responsible conversation about race, just as Celeste has dreamed we might, and we're going to do that later on this hour. You can weigh in, too. Attorney General Eric Holder once called us a nation of cowards when we talk about race. What do you think? Is the way we're talking about Harry Reid's comments a sign of cowardice or bravery? Tell us at 8778-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, behind the psychology of bank bonuses.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
You know, John, I lived very happily for 37 years. I never once thought about how much money bankers were making in their bonuses or their paychecks, either one.
Clearly, those halcyon days.
If you're just going over how many times I've read the Wall Street Journal looking at the size of these bank bonuses, then yes, I deserve a bonus myself. This week, Wall Street firms will hand out 6- and 7-figure bonuses to their employees. Yesterday, we heard some very strong arguments against the structure of those bank bonuses from economics professor Dan Ariely. Today, we're going to hear from someone who can explain why these bonuses are used, because he represents the financial services industry. Scott Talbot, welcome back.
Hi, thanks.
We're also joined by Jackie Calmes, national correspondent in the Washington Bureau for our partner, the New York Times. Her story in today's paper talks about the fee that President Obama is considering levying on the banks. Scott, though, I wanted you to listen to something that behavioral economist Dan Ariely said on the show yesterday. He was pretty critical of bonuses lined up for executives.
Before the recession, we thought that they had particular amazing skill. We thought these were people that knew something that the rest of the world didn't. They were super special, able, you know, they got the market to go up for about 20 years, and because they were so good and so talented, they deserve a lot of money. And the recession basically showed us that they were not that talented, they didn't know that much. In fact, there were lots of things that they didn't understand at all.
What's your response to that? For people who made so many mistakes, why would they deserve bonuses to the tune of hundreds of thousands or millions?
Well, it's important to note that the bonuses are driven by performance, and the industry has made a number of changes to de-link any pay practices that encourage risk. That's important going forward. But the bonus is designed to drive the salespeople to increase production and make sales, and that's what strengthens the institution, and that's what brings the economy back to health. So it's important to hold those carrots out there for them.
Now, wait a second, Scott, because if I understand this correctly, that's part of the problem that got us into the financial crisis, was this drive to up those sales targets. I mean, it depends on your definition of performance. The definition of performance before the crisis is what got us in trouble.
Yeah, and that definition has changed. We've eliminated those pay practices that encourage excessive risk-taking. It wasn't just about driving up sales. It was driving up any sale. And what we've done now is refocus the salespeople to focus on the long term and say only sell those products that in the long term, in the 3, 5, 7, 9-year time horizon, they will pay off for both the customer as well as the institution.
Okay.
And that's a key change to the pay structure.
Okay. Jackie Calmes, a correspondent in the Washington Bureau for our partner, the New York Times. There's been a lot of discussion, Jackie, about these bonuses. And in the end, the administration decided not to put a tax on individual bonuses. Why not?
Well, they have said all along, pretty much held to the principle, that the government should not be determining the pay schemes for these employees. That's for the shareholders. And they've argued that shareholders should get more involved on the corporate decisions of the corporate boards across the country for these financial firms.
Well, this idea that President Obama has to get some of the $700 billion back by issuing a levy on the banks, is that his idea of somehow getting the money back from the banks but without penalizing individual employees?
Well, there's a couple things here. There, you know, at bottom, it's an attempt to, politically, an attempt to sort of blunt some of the criticism the administration has been taking for its opposition to both assessing a tax on bonuses, a big, you know, remember early last year, the House had proposed at one point a 90% tax on some of the executive compensation, and Britain and France have proposed that. But mostly what they're talking about now is a levy that would, on banks, that would help reduce the deficit, blunt this anger, populist anger on both ends of the political spectrum, and, you know, show people that they're bringing down the deficit from after all the anger at the money that was spent on the financial bailout. But the interesting thing here is that the Treasury only a couple months ago released a report audited by the Government Accounting Office that said the bank portions of the financial bailout had actually made a small profit for the country. Hmm. The money that's being lost ultimately, or projected that will be lost ultimately, is from the money that was loaned to the automakers, to American International Group, AIG, and to programs that are trying, but not all that successfully, to avert home foreclosures.
Well, extending on what Jackie Calmes says there, Scott Talbot, it's being reported this morning that the Federal Reserve made $45 billion $1 trillion in the latest accounting. Right. And it's my understanding that no one at the Federal Reserve is going to receive a bonus, and that if anybody got Ben Bernanke's salary over at Goldman Sachs in their paycheck, that would probably be a pay cut. How can they make $45 billion, no bonuses, and Goldman Sachs has to do what they do?
Well, there's a huge difference between the private sector and the public sector. I mean, the private sector is a whole different ball of wax. If you paid government wages to the private sector, those employees would simply go to their competitors and seek their compensation elsewhere, seek their fair market value.
Well, why don't the people at the Federal Reserve leave? Why are there any employees still working at the Federal Reserve then?
Well, there are special bonus or special aspects to working for the Federal Reserve. You're serving your country, you're serving the government. There are different pulls, there are different types of compensation, using quotes here, to work for the federal government.
You know, I wanted to also listen to something that your colleague Jackie Eric Dash at the New York Times said yesterday about reform.
The banks now have paid back the TARP money that they took. The Pazar, he's almost powerless over the Wall Street firms. And the farther we get away and farther we get back to normal, the less we have at a chance of real reform, I think.
Jackie, do you think he's right? Have we waited too long to get any chance at reform?
Well, I think there is a good point to be made there. And in fact, you know, Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, said to people early on last year that the farther we got away from the financial crisis, the harder it would be to sort of push the financial industry to agree to or at least not oppose some of the reforms that would be proposed. And, you know, that's the nature of the game. And major legislation always takes a long time to get through the system, and especially now in this time when, you know, the House has passed a bill. It's the Senate, which, as we've seen on any given issue, effectively needs 60 votes, a supermajority, to get major legislation through, because 60 votes is what it takes to overcome a filibuster threat. So there's no question that there's sort of a disconnect between the fact that politicians are scrambling to stay ahead of this populist anger at the banks, and yet the banks as a lobby are continuing to have a fair amount of success in the Senate at least, you know, not stopping the financial regulation effort altogether, but at least trying to shape it more to their liking.
Jackie Collins is the national correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. We also spoke with Scott E. Talbot, chief lobbyist for the financial services industry at Financial Services Roundtable in Washington. Thanks to you both. It is 15 minutes past the hour now. Let's take a look at the headlines.
In southern Afghanistan, NATO says a missile fired from a drone has killed 13 suspected insurgents this morning. Meanwhile, China says it's successfully tested military technology that intercepts missiles in midair. And this test came shortly after the U.S. approved the sale of air defense missiles to Taiwan, despite repeated complaints from China. Back home, officials say the U.S. and five other nations will meet this weekend to discuss what to do about Iran's nuclear program. The meeting is tentatively set for Saturday in New York. And that comes on the heels of this report that a nuclear physicist in Iran was blown up, killed by a bomb. Iran is saying it's the U.S. and Israel. Of course, no comment from either Israel or the United States.
In sports, baseball commissioner Bud Selig is praising Mark McGwire for admitting he used steroids while he was a player. Selig says it should make McGwire's re-entry into the game, quote, much smoother and easier. McGwire has been hired by the St. Louis Cardinals as the hitting coach. Moving on to the skies, a collision expert says airspace is getting crowded as birds and planes compete for space. Preliminary data on encounters between wildlife and aircraft show that incidents could hit 10,000 for the first time. I wonder who wins that fight between the bird and
like,
the plane.
It's like air roadkill.
Pretty much.
Yeah,
and there's finally some warmth in sight for the eastern U.S., or at least relief from the cold. The National Weather Service says more seasonable temperatures will arrive tomorrow. Let's look at some of the stories you're watching this morning. Coming up, more about bonuses, the history of, with Louise Story.
Hey, you want that to go?
Lots to talk about this morning, and our first takeout is you keeping the discussion going on those Wall Street bonuses. We also have Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our sports contributor, and Louise Story here to talk about. We have a few questions about those bonuses for you, Louise, but first, listen to the reaction we've been getting.
I'm David. I'm calling from New Jersey. As for bankers' bonuses, I think they should get every
bit as much of a bonus as I'm getting this year and as most Americans are getting this year, which, in a word, is bupkis.
Sarcasm will get you everywhere. D. Shep emails us, it's laughable that they say they want to keep the best and the brightest. It's like they aren't talking about the same group of people that made bad decisions and did not grasp what they were doing. In fact, a former colleague said that the basic job title in banking is vice president. This should be a clue that something is wrong with this industry.
Meanwhile, Joel tells us,
there was a time in my lifetime when there was a marginal income tax rate up to 90% for very, very high incomes. That was eliminated, and I think that the private businesses should be able to arrange their salary structure the way they see fit as private businesses. But the offensive magnitude of these incomes ought to be addressed by the personal, I underline that, the personal income tax.
Dominica is taking a different tack. She emails, how do people not understand finance structure when you live and work in New York? Do you complain that athletes and celebrities are getting salaries? Do we complain when a 19-year-old gets a $10 million contract even though his team loses? Why wasn't that brought up when they're on trial for doping? Most banks did really well this year. If they were able to pay back the money and get out of the deal with the devil, then they should be able to have their bonuses.
Well, we want you to weigh in on anything that's got you talking in the news or in your life. Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You know how to email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. So we could probably do a whole hour show of people's voices expressing outrage or opinions about bank bonuses, et cetera. But it motivates us to step back and ask the question to you, Louise Story, New York Times finance reporter. Where did the whole bonus idea come from? It's really in the early days of banking in the United States, this idea of bonuses.
So really not all that long ago, John, like 30 years ago, most of the big names on Wall Street, the investment banks, were private partnerships. They were owned by their partners. This is like any small business out there. The people who ran it owned it. And so in a good year, they made the money.
So let's unpack that a little bit. So say J.P. Morgan, all right? This is the partner model, one of the big banks that is storied throughout American history. Rich people got together with their personal capital, which they pooled together as partners and went about making investments, and then the profit from those investments became their bonuses, right?
So that's right. In a good year, they scored. And some of the big partnership investment banks now are gone, but they were, you know, Bear Stearns in the 1980s and Lehman Brothers. And Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley were partnerships. They all went public. They all went through an IPO. Goldman Sachs was the last one to do it in 1999. During these IPOs, of course, the partners got very wealthy because they turned these partnership stakes into stock. Now, the problem was after they went public, they felt like they needed to reward employees in very good years, just like they had been rewarded in very good years when they owned the company. So they started doing this through year-end bonuses.
But isn't what changed that with the partnership model gone, these individuals were not putting up their own capital in the business, that they really weren't risking any of their own money. They were playing with house money, but the bonuses got bigger and bigger.
That's absolutely right. And that is one of the biggest criticisms that you hear within Wall Street. You know, within Wall Street, people who've been around a long time, a lot of them are nostalgic for this model where it was run by the people who owned it, and they were partners. Now, what's interesting is a lot of the reform you're seeing with bonuses, the push from the Obama administration has been to pay people more heavily in stock. And you know that the more you're paid in stock, the more you as an employee become an owner of the company. Then you're a shareholder. So we're kind of, don't know that it was purposeful, but it's kind of taking you back.
Back to the old days.
One of the more interesting proposals that I've heard about what you might do about bonuses this year, I don't know that no one's taking it seriously, but I've just heard some people, you know, commentators and people on Wall Street talking about it, is don't pay bonuses at all, but instead use all that money to pay a dividend, which would benefit all of your shareholders, including your employees, if you pay them in stock.
And
so that would be full circle.
Their dividend would be their bonus. Finance contributor Louise Story, lots to think about there.
Let's move on to sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. So, Ibrahim, we got some news from USC's former head coach.
Today is an opportunity really to give thanks for all of the people in the university and all that kind of contributed to this time here. And it really isn't about what's coming up next, about Seattle and all that. To me, this is about today here at SC.
That's Pete Carroll making very tough argument that it's not about Seattle. He is moving on to take the head coaching job for the NFL's Seattle Seahawks. Why do you think he's making this move?
Well, there is some speculation that the glare of the NCAA is focusing on the misuse of an SUV by Joe McKnight, the tailback at SUV, who's just now the junior tailback who's just now decided to go pro, as well as the continued focus and attention on the running back who was one at USC. Basically, there's all this attention on USC. This is the right time for Coach Pete Carroll to step away from all of that negativity and go into the NFL.
He was an NFL coach before.
He was an NFL coach. He didn't have much success. Well, in college, he was 97-19. That's an 83% winning percentage. And in the NFL, he was 31-33. He had a stint with the Jets and a stint with the New England Patriots before the Patriots became really good. So this will be another chance for him, and I think he'll do well.
Okay, there's another story, obviously, in sports that we're talking about today, and that's not Mark McGwire admitting he finally took steroids.
It was such a non-episode. Oh, really? Gee, could have fooled me.
Doris in Connecticut with a little bit of sarcasm of her own. We're going to be talking about Mark McGwire more, and we're taking your comments and responses to it at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the Big Mac gives us the recipe for his special sauce, Mark McGwire. Trying to get into the Baseball Hall of Fame, he admits he used steroids. We'll have more in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 30 minutes past the hour. Some good economic news to tell you this morning. The Federal Reserve made over $45 billion last year, the highest earnings in the history of the central bank. Maybe look at some ATMs. Those earnings, which are more than the expected profits of Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, and J.P. Morgan combined, will be returned to the U.S. Treasury. President Obama is considering some new taxes on the big banks to help refill those government coffers. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says they're considering a tax on banks, either based on the riskiness of their loans or as a tax on their profits.
I think that's the least the taxpayers are owed.
And Gibbs says any new tax would exempt community banks.
After 11 days and nights of cold, it's starting to warm up in Florida right now. It's up to 57 degrees in Miami after setting record lows over the past few days. But for Florida farmers, which provide 3/4 of the nation's fresh vegetables this time of year, the damage to the crops is being described as significant. They won't know the full extent of the damage for weeks. AOL is laying off more than 1,000 workers this week. The company says it expects to lose $200 million as it restructures. And last night, Jay Leno came out swinging at NBC.
I take pride in one thing. I leave NBC primetime the same way I found it, a complete disaster. So that's...
Conan didn't pull any punches.
Everybody now wants to know what my plans are. Everyone's asking me. All I can say is I plan to continue putting on a great show night after night while stealing as many office supplies as humanly possible.
They've actually been at it all week long ever since NBC announced its plan to move Leno back to the 11:30 Tonight show slot. Conan reportedly is considering a move to Fox. Let's take a look at the markets. Now the Dow is down about 42 points, the S&P down about 6, the NASDAQ down a little over 15 points. That's a look at some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
And yesterday, baseball slugger Mark McGwire sat down with Bob Costas on the MLB Network and talked about using steroids.
I started using it the winter of 93-94, going in that season.
Slugger Mark McGwire finally admitted to the world that he took those drugs, including during the historic 1998 season when he broke Roger Maris's record for most home runs in a single season. Mark Kreidler is a sports columnist and author of the book Six Good Innings. He covered both McGwire and Barry Bonds when both played in the Bay Area, and he joins us now from California. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, John.
You know, this has been a battle that Mark McGwire apparently has been having with himself, whether to come clean or not. Up till now, he's been completely tight-lipped on the subject of steroids. But it's also been a battle between sports writers such as yourself and Mark McGwire. People have been trying to get him to come clean for quite a while. How does this make him look? What's the score in this battle at this point? Should we feel sorry for Mark McGwire?
I don't think anyone needs to feel pity for McGwire other than, you know, maybe just on a real human level, it's clear that, if you look at what happened after he played, he basically went into seclusion. And he's one of the few people in this entire conversation about whom I think, at least I legitimately feel, that he felt shame because of the way he withdrew from baseball after he was finished playing. I don't think anyone needs to pity him. And I really do wonder look, he's talking now because he's about to return to the game as a hitting coach for the Cardinals. His longtime manager, Tony La Russa, who's really more of a second father to him, basically, I think, prevailed upon him. Look, you have to speak. You have to address this issue. And so I don't question the legitimacy of what he's saying, but in terms of the timing, and I think that it's entirely possible, were it not for this turn of events and his old manager saying it's time to come back to the game, were it not for those things, I don't think we'd ever heard from Mark McGwire.
Well, it's an emotional moment, but the money certainly is driving it here. And it also seems the fact that McGwire was on the MLB Network last night, that there's some interest in all of baseball to resurrect the reputation of Mark McGwire in some sense. Is that what you see happening here?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm very curious to see how this plays out. There was a extremely curious story last week from Tony La Russa, and he might have just been talking off the cuff, but he talked about the possibility this season of, you know, because Mark McGwire will be on the team as a hitting coach, of actually having McGwire back in a game as a pinch hitter or pinch hitting for the Cardinals down the stretch if they're in a pennant race. Well, if you read between the lines, anytime a player goes back and becomes an active player, it actually puts his Hall of Fame candidacy back on hold.
So it increases the eligibility time, and the votes McGwire has been getting in his Hall of Fame votes has been, you know, 25% or even less.
John, yeah, it freezes the window. And I just thought it was very curious. So if he were to play, there would be another five-year waiting period before he would be voted again. And I think that might be sort of a backdoor way of trying to freeze his candidacy long enough for some of his reputation to be restored.
Mark Kreidler, is Mark McGwire looking at the A-Rod model and seeing that he came clean and there were benefits to him, and then looking at the Roger Clemens model where he's going to fight this to the bitter end?
Yeah, there's Mark McGwire on one side and there's Clemens and Barry Bonds on the other. McGwire decided that A-Rod's model works, and it certainly does. Ask Andy Pettit.
Right.
Coming clean in America is almost always a good thing.
All right, Mark Kreidler, sports columnist and author of the book Six Good Innings. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. So, Celeste, we've been hearing from listeners on this whole Mark McGwire
using steroids.
And they're in roughly two categories. I mean, there's the category of people who say, duh.
My name is Glenn. I remember Sports Illustrated running an article on Mark McGwire. They said at the time that he was taking Andro. I don't understand why this is such a big to-do now, 20-some-odd years later.
My name is Doris Barton. I'm calling from my workplace in Greenwich, Connecticut. It was such a non-episode. Oh, really? Gee, could have fooled me.
But, you know, John, there are a few people who are more than ho-hum about the news. They were ticked. Here's Philomena.
Mark McGwire. He's like the boy who kills his parents and then throws himself on the mercy of the court because he's unfathered. It's ridiculous. He's lied to everyone around him for all these years, expecting people who care about him to believe him, and then he comes clean. What does that say to all the people that believed in what he said, that he was not lying, that he had not taken steroids?
You know, that's going to be going on in the minds of sports writers who will be voting on his Hall of Fame candidacy.
They that's are, exactly and in fact, argument. Some of our listeners are thinking the same thing.
Good morning, this is Mike from Wayne, New Jersey. My feeling is I feel very bad for Roger Maris, who legitimately broke the record, and they've really desecrated the record. And Roger Maris should be recognized for doing it the right way, doing it cleanly, doing it in a professional manner.
So there are lots of interesting takes on this Mark McGwire story. The steroid era really will always have Mark McGwire as one of the names associated with it. But Bark is trying to tie all of today's news together.
Mark McGwire and Harry Reid are the same story. These are guys who have risked their reputation for the sole purpose of setting the record straight. And for that reason, above all, they are to be admired. And by the way, John, I'm still your biggest fan. Celeste, welcome on board.
A belated welcome there from Bark. I have to say, Bark is better at doing a segue. I don't think I would have attempted a segue.
That was
Mark
an amazing,
it,
absolutely.
He's much better at segues than I am. Well, if you want to weigh in on McGwire or Reid or connect them in some way, you know how to reach us. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You know, actually, we have to do that segue. We have to go from Mark McGwire to Senator Harry Reid's comments.
That's our
coming
job.
Up, we're going to talk more about Senator Harry Reid's controversial comments about President Obama and how we've been hearing from so many of you also about race in America.
It's a factor that affects whites influencing black choices
and blacks as well, influencing their choices.
We're going to take a listen to what you're saying later on in this hour, and we are taking your nominations for who's having a good week and who's having a bad week. I'm guessing it's kind of a bad week for both of those folks. We team up with The Week magazine every Friday, so give us your nomination. Who's having a good week? Who's having a bad week? It can be a private story, a public story. If it's a good one, we'll run it on The Takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. You know, Celeste, if it had just been the story of Simon Cowell...
I think, in a way, it's a good thing for the show because I think it shakes it up. You know, there'll be speculation as to who's going to replace me. And all shows need that. You can't have the same people all the time. It gets boring.
Simon Cowell leaving American Idol. If it had just been that story, I don't think it would have been enough. If it had just been Leno and Conan...
Hey, NBC said they wanted drama at 10. Now they got it.
Leave television altogether and work in a classier business with better people like hardcore porn.
No, no, Simon Cowell, Leno, and Conan, that's all a stir in television. But them by themselves, they don't break the threshold either. It's got to be this voice on Fox that breaks it.
Ultimately, what the bailout does is help those who are concerned about the health care reform that is needed to help shore up our economy.
That's Sarah Palin. She's now a Fox contributor signing a deal with Fox News. That's going to be her gig for the next couple of years. Simon Cowell leaving American Idol. Leno and Conan, we have no idea where they're going to end up on the primetime or late night lineup. We have to call David Carr to get some clarity on all this. New York Times carpetbagger, blogger, and commentator on all things TV. David Carr, good morning once again.
A pleasure to speak with you, John.
It's going crazy at the networks right now. Which one of these stories do you want to take first?
Well, I love the Conan and Leno thing because it provides such a nice segue to Sarah Palin and going rogue. You have two late night hosts who are on a network taking a baseball bat to their network every single night. The network is giving them the window to do it. It's sort of like watching John and Kate. You're wondering, they're just sitting around waiting for the divorce and hacking at each other. As Conan pointed out, it's pretty dramatic television.
NBC is the reality network. It's not a reality show. It's an entire reality network.
Yeah, and Conan was joking last night about the fact that they're going to lose $200 million on the Olympics and just hugging himself about how great that was.
So what about Fox and Simon Cowell leaving American Idol? He's actually going to come to America with a competitor called The X Factor, which is successful in Britain.
Yeah, you got to think that he wants significant points in whatever he's doing. One of the things that, you know, he's very well compensated for a job he's good at. One of the things that surprised me is he said he was missing Paula, that it wasn't the same without her. And I never got the impression, as a fairly close watcher of the show, that he enjoyed that quality time with Paula, but he says he misses her.
Maybe Paula will go to Fox News.
Maybe Paula will go to X Factor. There's been some talk about that.
Where do you think the Leno-Conan drama is going to end up? Will they keep all three of those personalities, Leno, Conan, and, what's his name, Carson Daly and Jimmy Fallon?
I like Conan's take on that. They're going to throw them all into a pit with sharpened sticks, and whoever crawls out gets to leave NBC. I think that's how it ends.
And that's great in HD. You know, I'd really watch that, wouldn't you?
Pretty vivid television.
David Carr, New York Times carpetbagger, blogger, always the best voice on vivid television, talking about Simon Cowell leaving American Idol. Let's see if I can do this in 10 seconds. Conan and Leno at war over the late night slot, and Sarah Palin going to Fox News.
We're going to have a TV party, all right!
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, races is not just about the color of your skin, or is it? Is it about the color of your skin and the tone of it? We're going to talk about racism in America in a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. A new government report says the suicide rate of returning soldiers jumped 26% from 2005 to 2007. Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki says troops need to be treated for more than just bodily injuries.
Warriors suffer emotional wounds just as they suffer physical ones.
Of the 30,000 suicides in America each year, 20% are committed by veterans. Walmart has pulled children's jewelry items contaminated with cadmium from their shelves. Cadmium is a known carcinogen that, like lead, can hinder brain development. The Associated Press found that some Chinese manufacturers have been using cadmium in place of lead in children's jewelry, sometimes at very high levels.
In economic news, the U.S. trade deficit jumped to the highest level in 10 months. That's as an improving economy pushed up demand for some imports. President Obama and his wife head to Delaware this morning to attend the funeral of Vice President Biden's mother. Jean Finnegan Biden died Friday after falling ill in recent days. She was 92. And in the Netherlands, the woman who hid Anne Frank and her family from the Nazis has died at the age of 100. Miep Gies is also responsible for saving Anne's now famous diary. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Well, we definitely touched a nerve yesterday when we talked about some comments made by Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. He's quoted in a new book talking about the presidential campaign and saying that then-Senator Barack Obama had a chance of winning the election because he is, quote, light-skinned, and because he had, again, quote, no Negro dialect unless he wanted to have one. Lots of you say this is not a big deal for him to have said this. Several of you remind us there's still racism within racial groups. Patrick from Melbourne, Florida says this is a matter of truth in the black community.
I'm black, over 60. Reid said nothing but the truth. Blacks and whites treat light-skinned blacks differently. They treat them more favorably. Most blacks treat blacks of lighter skin more favorably. Reid didn't say anything that was negative about Obama. He simply said that white America is ready to accept a black of lighter skin who speaks proper English. Is that a problem?
Rochelle thinks it is. She called to say any comment that speaks the truth, like Patrick is talking about, just reflects our country's racism.
Rochelle Caslin from Carleton, Michigan. Being a fair-complected black woman, I have dealt with this type of issue various times in my life. And even though it's a factor that affects whites influencing black choices, and blacks as well influencing their choices, it's still racist.
But another African-American woman who called in stands by the truth defense and breaks this down as a matter of politics.
This is Mary from Farmington Hills, Michigan. As an African-American woman of 58 years, Harry Reid spoke the truth. I am not offended. The Republicans are desperate in trying to use anything they can to discredit the Democrats.
I cannot wait to get into this discussion because we've been waiting a while for real truth about this issue. Takeaway contributor Patrick Henry Bass is a senior editor at Essence Magazine. He's here to talk about it. We also have Raina Kelly, who's a staff writer at Newsweek. And Raina, you wrote a column saying that this country may be in a state of denial, that the fact that this came up, that we may just not be acknowledging some of the race issues that are at hand. Do you think that the country is not addressing these issues?
Well, to be fair, what I should have said was I feel like sometimes the media is not dealing with these issues. Obviously, you can tell from your listeners that they've thought about this. They know what they think on these issues, but the media pretends that not all the media, but many members of the media pretend that there are racial issues that are too terrible or too mysterious to be talked about, and that people aren't going to understand what the issues are at stake.
We are all media members, I should say, in interest of full disclosure at this table. Patrick Henry Bass, you work at Essence Magazine. Are there issues as media members that we just kind of shy away from?
Well, Essence is different, and the Essence caters to African-American women. And so we've been breaking barriers, especially in terms of the skin color issue. It isn't an issue as much for our readers because 12 times a year, we feature every type of hue of African-American woman and African-American man. And we've been doing that for 39 and a half years. So when our readers see African-American women, they see the multiplicity and the complexity, not only in personality, but also in skin color.
Now, just a second, because every single time I date a black man, I get dirty looks and sometimes even shouted at and insulted when I walk down the streets of New York.
Right, but that doesn't mean that every single African-American is shouting things at you. You know, are they just African-Americans? Are they white?
But it's an issue.
But that's because, let's just remind people, I mean, this is radio. It's because your skin is too light for
yes.
their taste? Is that what you're
They saying? Think I'm a white girl dating a black man.
But I'm saying that that's not the majority of African-Americans who are doing that to you. I don't understand. I don't know what pain those people are feeling, but saying the Essence magazine, when it first debuted, if you went to Ebony magazine, most of the ads had lighter skinned people. Most advertisers use light skinned people to sell their products. Essence chipped away, and it's not because I work for Essence magazine, but they chipped away at that stigma that the only African Americans that were acceptable not only to African Americans but also to whites were African Americans that looked
whiter. Did you have to fight that? I mean, you just said something pretty provocative. Do you have to say to an advertiser, "Hey, wait a minute, why are all these models light skinned?"
Well, the biggest fight that Essence had to have was to get Lancôme into the magazine, and they insisted on Isabella Rossellini remaining in the ads, and Essence accepted that ad because they felt that our readers were more sophisticated, that African American women knew how to go to cosmetics counter and put on makeup, whether it was Isabella Rossellini or Iman, who was the pitch person for that product.
Raina, there's something that you wrote in your column that was surprising to me. You said this issue brings up something that's unbelievably frustrating to African Americans. I'm going to quote you here. You say, "We get apologies for things no reasonable person would be offended by, non-apology apologies when we are offended." So are Harry Reid's comments things that we are not offended by?
I want to know what Harry Reid apologized for. I mean, and what that apology sounded like. My problem is these issues of, is what he said racist? Is what he said not racist? It just completely elides the topic, which is what he said, which is that there are some, what I like to call isms and schisms within the African American community when it comes to complexion, and that it may be more comfortable for America as a whole to elect somebody who's lighter skinned.
But why can't we
get into that? Like, which is what we're doing now.
But Raina, I don't think that is the issue at hand. The issue at hand was the fact that he robbed Barack Obama of all of his complexity with that particularly clumsy comment about race. It's quite clear that Harry Reid doesn't talk about race a lot. So if you look at it, President Obama's description of that comment as inartful was spot on.
All right, but so do you believe if Barack Obama had talked more like Al Sharpton and had dark skin, that would be a veto
of
his presidency, or he would still be elected?
John, what I'm saying is, if Raina or I interviewed Harry Reid, would he have said the same thing?
That's a good point.
Talking to African Americans in the way that he talked to those two white writers of that book. And so white people have two different ways of talking. Harry Reid does not talk to the Reno NAACP the way he talked to those writers.
To be fair,
Barack Obama does not talk to an audience of all white people the same way that he talks to an audience of African Americans in a church.
I totally agree.
Nobody speaks the same way under all circumstances. I mean, the way I speak to my husband certainly is not the way I came in here and am speaking to you. I mean, the idea that we have different voices does not mean that we have different faces. And I'm not exactly sure that Harry Reid knew the correct words to use. There's so much, you know, what's called code switching. It's hard to figure out what the right thing is to say. I mean, he said Negro dialect. Well, all throughout the election, we kept hearing this thing called preacherly cadence. Is that not the same thing?
Yeah,
it's just an acceptable way of saying the same thing.
Like an urban dialect.
And Celeste, I get called Jughead by this kid in my neighborhood every day. Just this little kid just screams at me and calls me Jughead. He thinks I have a Jughead.
Now you've opened a whole new can of worms on Jugheads here at the last.
I don't know what to do with that.
We could probably spend the rest of the day talking about this.
And
thanks so much. Patrick Henry Bass, Takeaway Contributor, Senior Editor for Essence Magazine, Raina Kelly, Staff Writer for Newsweek Magazine.
And tomorrow we will talk to the people who are reporting on that tidbit from Harry Reid, the authors of Game Change, Mark Helprin and John Heilemann. That's tomorrow on the show. But, you know, I think I'm going to call Patrick Henry Bass Jughead from now on.
You can't call him Jughead. It clearly bothered him, this little kid called him Jughead.
Yeah, well, whenever you've got something that's got you talking, and we can talk about this for the rest of the day, as you can tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Peter emailed us, "Now that Mark McGuire is out of the way," referring to a story we talked about earlier this hour, "maybe you can figure out if Bush was AWOL from the Texas National Guard, lied us into Iraq, and if Bill Clinton really didn't inhale. Can't wait. We'll get right on it, Peter."
We'll send out our best reporters. Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. I am Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. I'm Jughead. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.